BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thank you for downloading this episode of The Digital Human. This week, we're trying to hide, but we can't. It's faceless.
It is still very awkward for me to take a selfie. I don't like posting photos of myself online. And I am still, after 10 years, undecided how to deal with my own face. Your face becomes the source of trauma. And every time you look at your face, you look yourself in the mirror, or you look yourself in the camera of your phone, you see yourself, you see the trauma, your face becomes the nightmare.
In today's Digital Human, we are wondering where to hide now that we're being tracked by technology that wants to photograph, analyze, scan, and identify us everywhere we go. The program is a bit about privacy, a bit about autonomy, a bit about ownership, and a lot about politics, politics of the self and politics of the system. And what it comes down to is how we keep control of what we look like, because our faces are our identifiers. Is it even possible to be faceless in the modern world? Follow the conversation at #DigiHuman.
When people meet me for the first time, it becomes, and it sounds ridiculous, and it is ridiculous, but they think it's a big deal. They're meeting the faceless man for the first time. They know what I look like now. They're one of a select group who know my face.
Jonathan Hirschen has managed to do the impossible. He's kept his face off the internet for more than 20 years.
There is still no picture of me anywhere on the internet. In fact, if you do a search for me on the internet, which I would encourage you to do, if you do an image search of me, you'll see thousands of pictures that are tagged as Jonathan Hirschen. None of them are me.
Even more remarkably, Jonathan runs a marketing and PR company for the technology industry. You'd think that his face would be everywhere. After all, part of his job is to go to conferences around the world and give talks to technologists.
When you put yourself out there, you are literally exposing yourself to a level of data mining that you have no idea how far and advanced it actually is. I don't expect people not to post their pictures on the internet. I do expect them to at least think more about it. Once you get one picture out on the internet, it's too late. As soon as you have an adult face, and even in some cases, if you're preteen, algorithms can actually artificially age yourself. Once you make that choice, and once that first picture is out, it's too late. The genie's out of the bottle. You may as well post all the pictures you want, because once Google has indexed it and applied the data points to your face, it's all over. It's there forever, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Or is there? Researcher and curator Bogomir Doringer has noticed that artists have been experimenting with this idea for some time, and that there's been an uptake in the number of works that put facelessness in the foreground.
I became obsessed with faceless images from 2004, since I was at the Art Academy, and I noticed that there are a lot of artists working with this idea of hiding a face. So I wanted to understand why these images are being produced, what is the context, what is this artwork about. And the most confronting for somebody who was studying art at that time was that I was producing the same images. So I started obsessively archiving these images and diving in and trying to understand what they're trying to communicate.
It's not just artists posting faceless images, though. The trend is catching on elsewhere as we realize that our faces have value.
What's interesting with internet, some are very consciously produced, some are just an imitation. But the pile of these images that we are still today bombarded, but particularly in this case with faceless, was just really huge. So when I printed on the archive, you could see like thousands of images of faceless, and you couldn't even difference any longer if it's by a high-end artist or if it's by amateur, but it didn't matter because these images together, to me, they looked like a protest. like a kind of an agreement, collective agreement, that hiding the face is cool, that hiding the face is chic, that hiding the face is against the Facebook, that hiding the face is your right to be invisible. And also, you know, there was a rise of hipster photography, like a fast snapshots, and then everybody would always be from behind with a kind of wind in the hair. There was a kind of romanticism of it in a way. So when I started doing Faceless, I actually really wanted to show that something is not right, something is bothering people, that there is some kind of a collective restlessness, and it doesn't matter if it's in China or if it's in UK or if it's in States or in Serbia, we sort of agree and it bothers us the same things.
Here's the thing about identity. We have never been in charge of ourselves. Our reputations have always preceded us, and they're made up of what we want people to know and the things that other people say about us, whether we like that or not. And this has become particularly apparent as we've migrated online, because we can suddenly see what everyone thinks of us and who is shaping that image. And this is why Jonathan Hirschman's experiment to keep one little bit of his identity, his face, offline is such a challenge.
It's always difficult because I actually do a fair amount of public speaking. In one case, I was in front of 2,000 people, and I was terrified, and I still remain. Every time I go up in public, I'm putting myself at risk of getting photographed. Not because people want to, quote, out me. I'll give you a good example. Several years ago, I was about to speak in Croatia. So if I tell people before I even start my presentation, please don't photograph me, I know that they'll understand me. But this Croatian opportunity was different, because there were people from all over Southern and Eastern Europe there, and a lot of them did not speak English well. So the concern that I had was I was convinced I was going to get outed at this thing. 3 weeks before I went to Croatia, I went on Facebook. I do have a very active social presence, just no photographs of me. And I went online and I told people, look, I'm very nervous about being outed finally, and I'd like you to do me a favor. I want you to go online and start tagging every possible picture you can find as me. I don't care if it's male, female, a rock, a steaming pile of dung. I really don't care. Just tag it as me. And the reason for doing that is Google does not have what's called a canonical photo of me. A canonical photo is one that is guaranteed by virtue of who posted it to be showing the true face of somebody. The more pictures of me that come out from different people, if Google doesn't have a canonical photo, it doesn't know which of those photos is correct. So it's going to take basically an average of all of those pictures to try to find out what I look like. And considering it's doing it from everything from the animal, vegetable, and mineral kingdom, there is no way it will create a proper image of me.
One of the downsides of putting your face online is that it can be used out of context. For example, last year, a publicly accessible image of me was used to advertise housewares in the Netherlands. This was done without my permission or even my knowledge. But that's literally nothing in comparison with what researcher Neda Soltani experienced in June 2009. Earlier that year, she took a photograph of herself as part of an application for a conference. It was such a good one that she decided to use it for her Facebook profile. A few months later, on the 21st of June, an email landed in her inbox from somebody she didn't know. And before she could open it, she got another, and then another.
In a matter of, I don't know, a couple of hours, I had received over 300-something Facebook friendship invitations. People were adding me from all over the world. It was funny at the beginning, like the first 60, 65 friend invitations. But by the time it got to 300-plus, I was really confused and anxious about what was happening.
Towards the end of the morning, she got a direct message on Facebook from a journalist that explained what was going on.
The message said, "We are looking for the Neda Soltani who was shot to death on the streets of Tehran the day before. And because there were no informations available about her, people had started writing to all Neda Soltanis on Facebook and starting a process of elimination to hopefully land on the Facebook page of that one Neda Soltani who was killed the day before so that they could somehow connect with family members or friends of hers. What I did not know was by the time I read that, my face had already become her face and my name had become her name. We have a similar name. My name is Neda Soltani and her name is Neda Agha Soltan, the woman who was killed on the streets of Tehran during the presidential elections. She was murdered on the street by a sniper.
But by that time, her Facebook profile was being circulated around media outlets.
A friend called and I picked up the phone and I said, "What is going on?" And she said, "Are you okay? Why is your face all over the place?" I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "They are showing your face and they are saying your name and they are saying that you were killed on the streets yesterday." I went home, I switched on the satellite TV, which is very common in Iran, and there it was. I saw my own face with this black mourning ribbon on top of it and people calling my name and being in a state of shock on the camera. When you look at people crying over your death, that's a very surreal experience. But then at the same time, when you're sitting there, you know you're alive and you know that, wow, these are the biggest imaginable names in global media, and they are broadcasting a lie, a mistake.
Neda contacted the news agencies to tell them that there had been a case of mistaken identity, but Pandora's box was open. There was no way she could contain or reclaim that image of herself. By this time, her life was in danger.
In a matter of 3 days from when I realized what was happening, the Iranian Secret Service contacted me or tried to contact me. And on the fourth day, they showed up at the door of our home. I was the only part of this story, this tragic human story, that could work to their benefit. So they wanted to use me, and the fact that the media was running a fake or a false photo to their own advantage and to say the whole story or the whole history of the death or the murder of Neda Agha Soltan was fake and was Western propaganda. So I was summoned and I was asked to claim, "This is me, I'm alive, I'm fine, and the whole story of the death of Neda is fake."
Neda refused to cooperate with the Iranian Secret Service.
The Iranian Secret Service was telling me that not cooperating with them would mean treason against the national security of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And treason in Iranian penal code could mean death sentence. So they were telling me that if I would not cooperate with them, I could potentially be executed for treason. Like that, I went from a quiet scholar of English literature who had not even voted for any of the candidates in the 2009 election to a fugitive who had to run away for her life in a matter of 12 days. I escaped overnight with a small backpack and a small overnight bag. All of it happened in a matter of 12 days.
Putting your face online can have some unanticipated consequences.
After 10 years, I'm still sometimes struggling to wrap my head around what it means and what it did to me. The magnitude of such uprooting of a human being and being thrown out and away from everything that is familiar, from everything that is close to your heart and defines who you are. It is difficult, if not impossible, even for me who went through that, to put it into words. When a photo causes such a tsunami that washes away everything you have, but that is the face I have, and that is the face that I will have to live with for the rest of my life.
We are still going to post selfies because we cannot imagine something so extreme happening to us. And yet, technologies are being developed that are trying to reduce facial features into categories that say something about who we are and what we like. And while we are feeding the machine with photos of ourselves, we are also training it to make assumptions about us. It's those assumptions that can get us into trouble, as the cultural and political ideas of what is acceptable and not acceptable ebb and flow throughout history. Artist Zach Blass believes that the face is always political. He makes masks.
The very first mask I made was addressing an emerging set of studies. The first set of these studies came out around 2008 from top universities in the US, but these studies actually have continued. They've come out in Europe, they've come out in China, and basically a cropped photo of a face is flashed to you, like sometimes very close to the subliminal threshold, and then you're asked to say whether this face is gay or straight. So what really struck me years ago about these studies was actually how a biometric understanding of the face is permeating culture and kind of shifting, in a very broad sense, what we even understand a face to be and what we think a face gives to us or reveals to us. But the point is, these researchers were treating the face exactly in a biometric sense. Now facial recognition is much more heavily integrated into many commercial devices, even like our phones. Airports are a very kind of intense place where you see this often play out. And there was a lot about this some years ago with transgender people, you know, going through airports and getting subjected to biometric recognition. There were documented instances of transgender people going through like extra screenings on pre-terrorist suspicions. I think what's so important to think about with all of this is that as the years go by, more and more countries are basically, you know, creating biometric programs that are required for their citizens. So, you know, we're just seeing as the years go on that all around the world, biometrics, facial recognition included, are becoming this kind of primary way of identifying people around the world.
It's becoming so commonplace to use our faces as an identifier that we don't realize that we're giving up biometric data. Bogomir Doringer again.
We are now triggered to constantly give our face for sake of trying another mask, to see how we look if we get old, to try another gender. So we're experiencing some kind of technological drag. We are actually one-on-one or with our friends, digitally dragging ourselves. So what's happening is this massive manipulation from corporations mainly. On the other side, it's actually illegal collection of faces. So what the American government used to do in Iraq, and they had to build up a tent and record the faces of people, now we are doing it from our own rooms. Do we really care where all these faces are going? We don't, but recently popular app about trying to see how you will look as an older person or different gender, apparently is based in Russia. So they did publicly explain that they are not planning to use these faces for anything, and if you want, you can go back and delete your face. Yeah, but the company's in Russia, or my idol was in China. We very easily scan our faces and we send these faces somewhere, and we don't know where and why and what. But the question is, of course, when does your face become illegal? When do your face features become illegal? When does your skin color becomes illegal? When does your shape of your nose, of your eyes, etc. You know, next time when you go to United Emirates, maybe you get arrested at the airport because you're queer or gay, or maybe you smile too much. So again, I think the right word is that we are being choreographed, not for the first time, collectively, and this time with the use of technology. And it seems exactly like a script from science fiction movie that we know, but somehow we are still doing it because it's exciting.
As I started to research facial recognition, which was, you know, probably around 2000, 2010, 2011 was when I very heavily began this. This kind of actually led me into thinking about masking because was seeing various different types of social groups and social movements that maybe were like crisscrossing and having, different kinds of interactions. So, you know, whether it was anonymous or even like Pussy Riot solidarity protests around that time too. And what was so captivating to me about masking was, yes, protesters were kind of using it in this way to eschew individual identification, whether by, you know, human beings looking at them or also different types of surveillance devices. But I also thought the masks were about more than that. I think it's kind of a mistake, or it's a simplification, to think that protest masks are only about hiding. I think those masks are also about creating a kind of collective presence, that there's something about the mask that, you know, gives a collective consistency to a group. And I was very inspired by that.
Now, before you decide to sign up for facial reconstruction surgery, a dramatic solution that some have taken, here's a reality check. Computers are not that clever yet. They can be confused by makeup, by patterns on t-shirts, and even white noise. And that is useful for people who want to make their voices heard, but don't want their faces to be remembered.
There's much surveillance in Hong Kong, in the city. In China, there are many cities under the CCTV surveillance, and Hong Kong is becoming one of them. And that's a really proper explanation or rationale behind that, why we wear masks during our protests. It's because we have to protect our identities and privacy and prevent retaliation from the Hong Kong government and police. We try to cover ourselves. And because of the white terror, the Chinese or like the Hong Kong government is trying to implement on us.
Stephen is from Hong Kong. Stephen is not his real name. And that is because in the summer of 2019, he and tens of thousands of students occupied the city streets in protest against the Chinese government.
Many people try to be creative. They try to like paint or like faint painting different colors or like different paints to cover their identities. But I believe that wearing a mask is still a consensus between protesters or like the majority of the Hong Kong community. Because when you really looked into the anti-mask order, it was like really targeted to protesters or when a protest has begun. So there's a consensus between the Hong Kong community.
Stephen and his fellow protesters are afraid of being identified and published, something made much easier by the surveillance cameras positioned on so-called smart lampposts around Hong Kong streets.
In Hong Kong, we tried to break a Hong Kong smart lamppost, which is a really intelligent system which tried to recognize and quickly identify the identity of citizens. Is perceived as a spying system over the citizens. Beijing, Shanghai, they're all having lampposts using the same hardware they were used in Hong Kong.
What concerns Stephen and other protesters is that it's a very similar surveillance technology to a system being rolled out in mainland China called Sharp Eyes.
The Hong Kong citizens believe that the implementation of Hong Kong smart lampposts has been imposing a kind of a white terror towards Hong Kong citizens.
What's happening is that the face is becoming a way to authenticate our identities, like a password. In many metropolises in China, the face is used to pay for things in vending machines or train tickets. It's used to let you on an airplane or into your office, and it gives you access to your bank account and your apartment. Being faceless is now not an option, because if you are, you become pretty restricted. Which brings us back to China's Sharp Eyes. Using the facial recognition technology in the lampposts, the government is tracking its citizens' behavior, and it's using the information to reward pro-social behavior and punish antisocial behavior. If you help an old lady across the road, your social credit score goes up. But if you leave a bike in the middle of the road, your social credit score goes down. By the end of 2020, they say that each citizen will have a 3-digit credit score number that will define what you have access to and what you don't. And that is what Stephen and his fellow protesters are worried about.
In China, when it's about the Sharp Eyes, is a system which monitors the daily actions or like everyday action, every single action by, for example, in Xinjiang, when they have CCTV like literally every corner of the street, and try to make a surveillance effect on citizens, on people. Of course, there's a credit system. It's already implementing in the majority cities in China. It's about how a certain action is equal to a certain credit. And we believe that in the coming future, for example, 3, 4, 5 years, or even shorter period of time, the same system, the same credit system will be implemented in Hong Kong. And that really frightened us.
But sharp eyes can only watch people on the streets of China, right? Well, yes, but of course there are other means of surveillance. Stephen is now studying in the UK. At the weekends, he's been demonstrating on the streets of a major British city. And although he's far from Hong Kong's smart lamps, he and his fellow protesters continue to wear masks.
We wear masks every time when we hold street stalls. The main rationale or the main principle behind is that we try to protect ourselves from the Chinese who take photos of us. Because every time when we hold street stalls, there's many mainlanders will come to our street stalls and try to take photos.
We have a proliferation now of creative and subversive gestures around ways to evade facial recognition. And to be honest, I often think these are a little bit fetishized. And I guess what I mean by that is, we can come up with all these ways of disrupting the face, but we're not going to be able to wear that at the airport when our faces are getting scanned.
Back in October, we tried to call the police as well when a mainlander, he tried to pull off a mask from my friend, who is also a protester, and we considered it to be a really dangerous action, which endangered our personal safety.
Stephen believes that his face could now be known by Chinese and Hong Kong authorities and will trigger a facial recognition system as he enters the Hong Kong airport.
When they take photos of us, we fear that back in Hong Kong, or even back in China, we fear that the photos that they have taken, they try to recognize us and try to, like, it gives us a punishment. That's kind of like a fear generated inside us, every protesters that have been taken photo to.
Facial recognition is astonishing. It is remarkable. It means we can find photos of our friends, we can see what we'll look like when we get old, and it can let us into our smartphones. These are the solutions that we want. But the technology that's making our lives frictionless is also being used to contain us, to suppress us, to control us. And we are feeding the machines with the pictures of our faces. So far, we can fight back. Simple hacks like masks and makeup. They show the limits of what the technology can do. Even if we try to be faceless, it will get smarter. And if we allow it, we won't ever be able to escape recognition. You've been listening to an episode from BBC Radio 4's Digital Human. I'm Alex Krotowski. The producer this week was Kate Bissell.
Hi, everybody. I'm Caitlin Jenner, and I am a guest on Simon Mundy's Don't Tell Me the Score podcast. We talked about everything, the Olympics, trans issues, and all the lessons that I have learned along the way. I really enjoyed recording the podcast, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. You can hear it on BBC Sounds. Just search for Don't Tell Me the Score.